This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Anthony Scoma. Today on the program, a panel of experts discusses the important role that sources of local media play in Utah and across the country. The 2022 legislative session has seen a pair of issues that have placed the Utah legislature at odds with local media outlets and advocates. The first, HB 96, imposed a fee aimed at so-called vexatious requesters, who file multiple grammar requests within a 10-day period, with the intent to bog down government entities and employees. A compromise amendment added in the Utah Senate carved out an exception for media members before winning passage and heading to the governor's desk. The second issue was a change to Utah Senate rules that would bar access to areas of the Capitol without prior approval or while accompanying lawmakers. Security and privacy concerns were both offered in favor of the rule's adoption, while virtual meetings were cited for offering robust public access to the legislative process. The resolution passed 17-5, with Senator John Johnson being the sole Republican vote against the rule change. This week's panel will also explore how local media is tied to more accountable government and engagement with local communities. The panel includes Jay Evanson, senior editorial columnist at the Deseret News, Lauren Gustis, executive editor of the Salt Lake Tribune, Josh McCrane, assistant professor with the University of Utah's Political Science Department, and Renee Bodley Miller, general manager of KPCW. Moderating today's discussion is Elaine Clark, news director at KUER. This forum was recorded on September 18th, 2021. Here's your moderator, Elaine Clark.
We're talking about local news today, and I'll confess my bias right from the outset. Local news matters. Research shows that when there's less coverage of local issues, there's more straight ticket voting, incumbents have an advantage at the polls, cities see a slip in their credit rating because there's less accountability from elected officials. And get this, clearance rates for violent crimes drop because of less attention on police from the public. All that while the media landscape has changed wildly over the last few decades. Newsrooms have shrunk, newspapers have collapsed, and that leaves some communities with fewer sources of local news. Some don't have any at all, which is a moment for me to say how grateful I am that we have two remarkable print news sources in our community, the Salt Lake Tribune and the Deseret News. TV stations have consolidated, and make some confessions for radio here. Commute habits have changed during the pandemic, which means the way listeners engage with radio has changed. So what does all this mean for the kind of journalism local outlets deliver? There's a lot to talk about. So let's just get straight to introducing the panelists. I'm also going to say a bit about the ownership of the outlets they lead, because it's really important for today's conversation. Lauren Gustis joined the Salt Lake Tribune as executive editor in the fall of 2020. Before that, she was president and executive editor of the Sacramento Bee. She also served as McClatchy's West Region editor, where she oversaw 10 outlets in California, Washington, and Idaho. This is actually her second stint with the Tribune. In mid-2000, she was assistant sports editor. The Salt Lake Tribune was bought by businessman Paul Huntsman in 2016, but made national headlines 3 years later when it became the first major metropolitan newspaper to become a nonprofit. Lauren, welcome. Thanks for being here. Jay Evanson is senior editorial columnist for the Deseret News and has been a member of the editorial board since 1994. He was a reporter before that in New York, Las Vegas, and in Salt Lake, covering politics and local and state issues. The Deseret News is owned by Deseret Management Corp. That's a holding company for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. It also owns Bonneville International, which includes KSL Television and Radio here in Salt Lake. Jay, thank you for joining us. Renee Bodley Miller is president and general manager of KPCW in Park City. Before joining the station, she spent 25 years reporting and producing for and leading local television news around the country. She was vice president and news director at KSTU Fox 13 here in Salt Lake City for 16 years. The station underwent some ownership changes while she was there. Conglomerates in New York and later Chicago held it. And since she's now with KPCW, this is a really great opportunity because she, of course, that's the public radio affiliate for Summit and Wasatch Counties. It's a nonprofit with a volunteer board of trustees chaired by Rob Richard, who's a community activist and former city and county politician. But anyway, thank you. And finally, Joshua McCrane is an assistant professor of political science here at the University of Utah. His research focuses on public policy, lobbying, Congress, and most relevant to our conversation here today, on media and politics. In 2019, he co-authored a paper called Local News and National Politics, which looks at how Sinclair Broadcast Group's ownership of TV stations around the country influences local news coverage. Josh.
Excellent.
Thank you. I'm going to start with what may seem like a really obvious question, but how do you define local news? What is local for you? Is it about geography? Is it about audience? The sources in your stories? What's local mean for?
That's me.
Yeah.
thank you. You know, for us at the Tribune, local news has to be relevant. It has to matter. You have to care enough to want to read it. And therefore, you have to be able to say that you're not going to find what you found in the Tribune anywhere else. So I think that's a delineator between national and local, right? No one is going to do the story that the Tribune or the D-News or KCPW would do on a couple of towns that lost their water supply and therefore are no longer allowing building here in Utah. I shouldn't say no one. No one's going to do it first, because shortly after we did it, the New York Times did it. They kind of called it their own, no credit or anything. Not that I'm bitter. I should also add, as a nonprofit, we've had a lot of conversations about how our mission changes and what local journalism means as our structure has evolved. And I think it's really important that we focus on how we can strengthen communities. And that means that we do point out the problems, right? So, for example, this past weekend, we wrote about how Utah prisons were essentially ineffective in dealing with the coronavirus. And as a result, 18 prisoners who had asked for early release died while they were in prison in Utah during the coronavirus. So we absolutely want to point out the problems, but we also want to think about what those solutions might be and how can we also elevate solutions. So, for example, this weekend, we also reported on heat deserts on the west side of the Salt Lake Valley, and how there are fewer trees over there than there are here, right? And therefore, it is hotter over there than it is here. And so what is the solution? Any guesses?
Plant trees.
Yes. Plant more trees. Not hard, right?
I read that.
But at the same time, how do we get a conversation going about, okay, so here's the problem, and where does the solution take us such that we will strengthen communities?
Renee, KPCW is focused on the Wasatch Back, so maybe really putting the local in local news. Do you think of it, how you define local news, any differently than a statewide outlet?
We do. Thank you.
Sorry.
We do. We define local news as something that is pertinent to a resident of Summit and Wasatch County, or anyone who may feel an affinity with the Park City community. And that can mean many people, because a lot of people love to recreate in Summit and Wasatch County, go to those ski resorts. We do have conversations in our editorial meetings about, is KBR covering this? Is Salt Lake Tribune covering this? Is statewide media covering this? And a great example for us on how local news makes a real difference was the Parley's Canyon fire that just happened a couple weeks ago. Statewide media was up there Saturday when everyone could see that big plume of smoke. Sunday, they decreased the acreage from about 3,000 acres to about 514. Maybe there was a halfway point, 600 and something. But as it decreased in acreage, you saw a decrease in coverage from statewide media, and I understand why. But there was still an evacuation order in place that affected 5,000 homes. So we stayed on it during regular updates, and we got a lot of positive feedback from our listeners about that, because they said no one else was giving them hour by hour updates and information. That's where local news, I think, makes a really big difference.
And Jay, let me add a layer to this, if I may. The Deseret News covers regional politics, business, police and courts, education, the whole kit and caboodle. But it's also serving a Latter-day Saint audience. I'm thinking about church news section and on the website. Does that audience complicate how you think about what local means? Or is it sort of bifurcated?
Well, I think it complicates it in a way. I mean, more than 70% of our online readership lives outside of Utah. So, sure, you know, we're trying to be both a local paper covering the city council and what's happening in your area, but we also are trying to have a nationwide, a national influence on giving that readership what they want. And so, yes, we have the advantage of having a partnership with KSL, which helps us with our local coverage. We started several years ago focusing on different areas of emphasis that can include local coverage, but also national coverage, such as financial responsibility, faith and its role in our society. I'm not going to be able to remember all of them, but these are all areas that we, through our surveys, have found that our audience is interested in. And they are angles to stories that, frankly, our readers aren't getting anywhere else. And so we found that to be advantageous online, certainly. But as the Tribune, we have a once weekly paper that we circulate here in the area. And so, yes, I guess to answer your question, it does complicate it, but we feel it's doable.
Josh, I really do want to just dive into your research now. Do you have anything you want to add to what you've been hearing here, or maybe define local news, how you looked at it in your research?
Yeah, sure. I mean, so I think that, you know, as scholars, we don't actually have a good definition of what we think of as local news, but I think implicitly what we have in mind is something about accountability to a community, and there's some basis where you are trying to cover things that are relevant to the people in the area in which you live. And the one thing I'll add before I get to the research side of this is really interesting is this is actually a regulatory matter. So what the FCC did during the Trump administration is they told television stations they no longer had to have a physical station in their media market anymore, which sort of starts to break this kind of community aspect of what especially local television news is, which I think is like a really interesting mechanism for there could still be a local television station. They don't actually have a presence in the community, which makes it kind of interesting to think about what exactly that means vis-a-vis like these ideas of local news. I don't think there's any of that here in Utah, but that definitely is something that's happening elsewhere in the country. But yeah.
So you look specifically in this paper that I mentioned at stations owned by Sinclair Fox Broadcast Group back in 2017-2018. These days, I was looking at their SEC report. As of December 31st, they own 188 TV stations in 88 markets. So just dive into your paper and give us the overview. How does Sinclair ownership influence the kind of news stories that air on local channels?
Yeah, absolutely. So this paper is about Sinclair because Sinclair is one of many major conglomerate media owners. And by conglomerate, I mean they just own a whole bunch of stations across the country. So traditionally, there used to be some smaller ownership groups that would own some like regionally focused stations. That's kind of no longer the business model in local news. So what we saw was, and you might have seen this as well, I think I saw it first in the John Oliver show where like all of these anchors across the country were saying the same exact things during live broadcasts. I thought that was interesting. So we wanted to understand if that is like more of a systematic thing. And if it is, what are the effects of this ownership change, the acquisition of Sinclair by a station? What is the effect of that? So what we looked at is we looked at media markets in which there was an acquisition by Sinclair in this time period in 2017. Sinclair bought this smaller ownership group, bought media, they bought all of their stations. And so what we wanted to see is, okay, is first of all, is Sinclair kind of changing the style of content in those stations? And second, we know Sinclair has really, really strong right-leaning political motivations. They're not very subtle, but I'm trying to hide that. And is there an effect on the slant of the content of the stations that they buy? And so what we find by comparing stations in one media market to the stations in the same media market, right? So we have, so there's still like this, there's this baseline level of coverage that's expected. There's this baseline level of slant within a media market, right? So say we're comparing stations in the Salt Lake City market to the other ones in the same market. We're not comparing like stations in Salt Lake City to stations in New York City, for instance. And what we find is when Sinclair buys a station, that station spends 25% less of their time on local news and 25% more of their time on national news within an individual broadcast. And that's a pretty reliable finding. And then so we also look at the slant of the coverage. Again, the idea is that they have political motivations. Do we see that? So we find just some complicated measurement techniques is that stations that are bought by Sinclair move more to the right, again, relative to other stations in the same market, right? So there could be conservative slant because it's a conservative market, we expect that. But Sinclair stations still move to the right of those. And we also find those stations also look more like Fox News rather than CNN, for instance, and in the style of the content. We use some machine learning and stuff to do this. And then finally, what we find, so Sinclair has been asked about this research because they were worried about it because they were trying to buy, Turner Media at the time. It was a regulatory process. And they say, well, look, if there's any change in slant, that's because this is what the consumers want in the markets, right? We're just responding to this demand for more slant content, which is a kind of natural explanation for this. And so what we find is there's no viewership increase when Sinclair buys these stations. If anything, viewership decreases. So there's no real explanation that makes sense based on this untapped demand for right-leaning national political content from local news. So that's not what you would expect. Sinclair, if you follow Sinclair's explanation, viewership would increase. And we see the opposite. So that's kind of that's the basic summary of what that paper is. And we can talk about it later if this generalizes to some other settings as well.
Renee, I know, let's make this clear from the outset. Fox 13 was not a Sinclair station. I'll say that right off the bat.
It almost was.
Most stations almost were.
But you worked for a decade and a half at Fox 13 here in Salt Lake City. It was local news. Is local news with national ownership? Can you talk about the impact you've seen over the years of remote ownership on how much local news you can do?
Sure. First, when I became news director there in 1999, we were owned by Fox, and we were owned by Fox until 2008. And so every year we would go to New York and present our budgets to Rupert Murdoch or Lachlan Murdoch, who had a really creepy tattoo, by the way. But interestingly enough, at that time, working for News Corp, nobody, Roger Ailes, Rupert Murdoch, no one would call me and say, cover news this way. If anything, we had complete editorial control, and we also had control over our clock. Fox Network News, most Fox affiliates go on at 10 p.m. at night, and other networks go on at 11. That's because other networks give you network programming up into that time. We didn't, so that's how we could put on a 9 p.m. news in the Mountain Time Zone. It's how we were able to expand in the midday. It's how we were able to expand in the morning. Gosh, I think they're up. Do they go on at 4:30 in the morning now? But we went from 2.5 hours of news a day when I joined that station in 1996 to 11 hours of news a day when I left in 2015. And we were really proud of the amount of news that we were putting out there. Now, sometimes that means, you know, it impacts content. You need the resources to do that. But in terms of the ownership, you know, Fox O&O, I felt like we had complete license to do whatever we wanted. Then when we were sold to a hedge fund, to Local TV, which was a group of investors, that's when it happened in 2008. We were in the middle of a recession in 2008, so everyone had to clamp down. There were a lot of cuts. We just used dark time. Fortunately, we did not have to lay anyone off. All the other TV stations did. That was a really long time. Then we were sold to Tribune Broadcasting. And basically what local TV did, they cut everything down to the bone, and people got bonuses once it was sold to Tribune, and the Tribune was looking to sell it to Sinclair. Did I answer your question?
Yeah. It depends is what I'm hearing. It depends on the owner and what they want out.
It does. So definitely under local TV at that transition, we saw it's time to really scale back and make money. And that's also a time when traditional broadcast advertising was starting to go to digital. So TV stations weren't a pitch. TV stations were still basically a license to print money. Their local affiliates made a lot of money. Whether they make this much money or this much money, I think, is what the difference was. But yeah, I did not see under local TV or under Tribune any editorial.
But we'll be talking a lot about that money.
Jay, I want to get you in here because I'd like to hear you on the role of ownership and what kind of role that plays in the kind of stories, local stories you're able to cover. And you touched on it, we've touched on it a little bit, that you have sort of two audiences, right? A national same audience as well as the local audience. Certainly in the newspaper ecosystem here in Utah, there's been a divide in local consumption of news between the two papers. How do you explain the influence the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints has on the paper as its owner, and specifically on the local news?
Well, it's a lot less than a lot of people think. I worked prior to coming to Salt Lake. I worked in Las Vegas, and just because you have local ownership doesn't mean you don't have some of these problems that we're talking about. But they were recently bought by Sheldon Adelson, and there have been a lot of problems down there based on that. And when I worked there, it was owned by Don Ray Media. Don Reynolds was still alive, and he was very interested in profit over anything else. And not speaking of the dead, but that influenced a lot of what we did and how we covered things. I have not seen that kind of influence exerted by church leadership at the Deseret News, particularly covering local issues. They want to be a good corporate citizen. They want to have a good place in the community. We're not just interested in covering news, but we are a corporate citizen in the community. We're interested in making the community a better place. We sponsor things like the Sterling Scholar Competition and Deseret News Marathon, and I know the Tribune does some things as well, and I think this is where local leadership can be a real asset to a community. naturally, we know who our owner is. We're probably not going to do a huge expose on the church, but in my years of being there, I have never had anyone say, "Oh, ownership wants to do this or do this type of a slant." That just hasn't been an issue.
No stories by or columns by?
No, absolutely not. And that hasn't always been the case. Again, going back to Las Vegas, I remember a time when I was doing some stories that didn't reflect well on a local shopping mall. And I had the editor of the paper in Las Vegas come to me and say, they're a big advertiser. Why don't you lay off? I've never seen that happen here.
That was Jay Evanson, senior editorial columnist at the Deseret News. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts, more local shows, and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW. Welcome back to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Anthony Scoma. Today, a panel discussion on the importance of local media. Here again is your moderator, Elaine Clark, news director at KUER.
Lauren, the Salt Lake Tribune is now a nonprofit, but it was owned by Paul Huntsman from a very powerful, influential Utah family. He still serves as chair of the board of directors. I think back to his brother John Huntsman Jr.'s run for president, and every time there was an article during the election season, disclosure nice and big down at the bottom. But talk about that ownership of Paul Huntsman and
how the transition to a nonprofit in both of these models, how that ownership influences what you produce.
There's an influence on an organization regardless of who owns it, right? You got it, I got it, you got it, we all got it. And so how onerous is it, right? To your point about Sinclair, I think it's a concern, right? And then what do we do with that, right? And you mentioned the disclaimer. We still regularly run disclaimers that detail Paul Huntsman's involvement in the Tribune. And I firmly believe that if Paul had not stepped in to buy the paper, the Tribune would not be here today. Wouldn't have happened. We were owned by a hedge fund that was sucking money out of us, and we were going to wither, right? And they were fine with that. So Paul bought the paper. A couple years later, he turned it into a nonprofit. And now we are essentially led or steered by an 11-person board that includes individuals from up and down the state. Its diversity outstrips the diversity of the state, which I think is really important as we look at where we're headed and how we're going. For me, it means I have 11 bosses, so I can make no one happy all of the time, and that's fine. But Paul's brother, James, recently decided to sue the church over a dispute that centers on James's tithing and where that 10% went. The case is continuing to work its way through the courts in Southern California. That's where James filed. We have written a story at every turn of the wheel as that case has proceeded. And if it were the other way around and the church was suing the Huntsmans, we would do it the same, right? With a disclaimer always, Paul is the board chair of the Salt Lake Tribune and so on and so forth. Not once has Paul said a word to me about how he reported that story.
Do you think about an editorial firewall between you and your team and the board?
Yes, the board has a set of parameters that it follows, that it adopted, and that it all signs off on as new board members join and so on and so forth. The board's responsibility is to ensure the fiscal stability of the Tribune, which is no small task, and to engage in conversation about the senior leadership of the organization. So that would be me and my counterpart on the advertising side, right? But outside of that, it's very clear where the lines are, and therefore makes conversations, should we ever have them, fairly simple in that you refer to the document, which is also on our website.
Renee, I want to come back to you for just a moment here to talk about the radio model. KPCW is also a nonprofit. You have a board of trustees and a membership rather than a subscription model, which we'll get back to in a moment in the economics part. But I wanted to ask you to talk about how that model, the public radio model, influences the local news that you produce and the amount of time you're able to dedicate to local news.
I love the public radio model. I love the nonprofit model of local journalism, and I fervently believe that's going to save local journalism. When it comes to the board of trustees, by the way, Bob Richard turned out. No worries. It's Roger Goldman now. Website's right. I think it is. Roger Goldman is a retired Washington, D.C. attorney who's lived in Park City for many years. He's now the chairman of our board. Is the question how much time do we spend on the board?
Well, yeah, I guess that was kind of an unfair question. There was a couple of questions in there. Because I'm thinking about answering to that board, in a way, answering to members of the station who I think feel ownership in a way, stations that maybe subscribers don't, a big conversation that happens in the public radio ecosystem.
Unfortunately, I have never had to have a conversation with a donor about editorial coverage. And it's been made very clear to me by the board and by the public radio infrastructure, groups like Greater Public that has webinars for general managers and news directors. The right thing is you don't let anybody influence your editorial decision-making, no matter how big that donor may be. We have received scope of criticism within the Park City community that a developer in town, Columbus Pacific Properties, who is developing Pendry residences and developed a couple of things in town, they have been a supporter of the station through underwriting and also personally through some personal donations. And I've never said word one to anybody, to Brian Shurkin or Tony Tyler or Columbus Pacific, about our coverage and what we cover and how we cover it. And we have a very clear editorial policy on our website that's in part mandated by the Institute for Nonprofit News, of which we are a member. And we had something up there before, but INN is helping us and other local nonprofit, mostly startups now across the country, with editorial policies and transparency and definitely disclose who your donors are. Our biggest donors are our broadcasters club, and we have those names all up on our website, our underwriters all up on our website. So fortunately, knock on wood, I've not had any uncomfortable moment with a federal board member or, that's not true. I did have an uncomfortable conversation with a board member one time about the coverage of a spouse who's a city council member, and we agreed to disagree.
So coming back to Sinclair, and I mean, you've obviously, sending your work, that so much of this has to do with money. The Sinclair shift, as you mentioned, you know, if it doesn't have to do with demand, then it must have to do with economies of scale and being able to produce one piece to package and send. But sort of to the bigger question, your research shows there's an appetite for local. People trust it. People want it. People pay.
Yeah, this is really interesting to hear about these local nonprofit models. So I've sat in a lot of rooms with a lot of people where the idea was that it is going to be nonprofits. The nonprofit model is going to save, especially local newspapers. That's what we're really concerned about is, as you guys know, local newspapers are falling out of the country. And that's an interesting question because it sort of presumes there's going to be still some demand for people who are willing to pay for it, right? And it's not obvious that that's true or even clear that that's the case at all, right? And it could be the case in some places like here and places like where I used to live in Lansing, where people were willing to donate, right? But the places where we don't have what we call news deserts, which is something like 250 counties in the U.S. have zero local news. Over half of all counties in the U.S. have only one local newspaper. So these places that have basically no local news coverage, it's unclear that there's a sustainable business model at all that is a money-making enterprise for local news. You know, so I think, you know, one way we could look at this is that it's not supposed to make money. It's supposed to be a public good, as are other things that are public goods, something that we can all take advantage of and we're all better off if it exists. But that requires a whole lot of collective action, mostly political. Or you can somehow coordinate a whole bunch of really, really rich donors to just prop up a business model that's never going to make money. But we'd still probably be better off societally if that was the case. And I think that's probably the most realistic solution for a lot of these communities that just don't have any local news at all that covers them.
Laura, you want to jump in?
Yeah, thank you for that. You all have your laptops up, you're online. Can someone Google the Salt Lake Tribune and tell me what you get? It used to say the Salt Lake Tribune is dying. I know, is that rough? And the perception for sure, and the reality in many, many communities is that local newspapers are dying. And then it gets even harder to get people to buy in, right? Why would I support a loser, right? I want to be on the winning team. Sorry, Utah.
Snap.
It would have been better coming from you. So with that, the Tribune has both a subscription, and then it has an offer for supporting subscribers. So a digital subscription to the Tribune costs you $79 a year. May seem like a lot if you are a full-time student. I get that. But not a bad value for local news for the course of the year. Or you can subscribe and be a supporting subscriber for $150 a year. And to your point about, are there enough people who will pay for it? There are super supporters. There are people who care so much. We don't yet have the model. The Salt Lake Tribune is the only major metro that has made this transition to a nonprofit, right? And this year, for the first time, and I have no idea how many years, we will be sustainable, right? We will be profitable as a nonprofit. So as we look at next year, how do we grow, right? How do we reinvest in communities by hiring more reporters? Where do we need help? Where is there a gap, right? Where are the news deserts in Utah and there are many? And I would just submit that we feel like we've been fumbling around in the dark for a long, long time. One of the reasons that I am here and that I believe so strongly in what we're doing is because I think that potential exists to make that transition, because there's enough awareness amongst people across the country that we are in like a serious pickle. And how can I help? There are creative people who are working to figure that out.
That was Lauren Gustis, executive editor of the Salt Lake Tribune. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Anthony Scoma. Once more, here's your moderator, Elaine Clark.
I'm going to use that term super supporter to segue over to you, Jay, and talk about how much of the paper's revenue relies on subscription and if you think that's sustainable. And could you continue without the financial support of Church Orange?
Well, that's an interesting question. And I'm not privy to all the particular information about where revenue comes from. I'm a columnist, editorial writer. But I do know that we have several ancillary businesses that used to be tied to the Newspaper Agency Corporation. And they are profit-making businesses, and Utah Business Magazine, and I can't name all of them. And I know there's some real estate concerns as well. And profits from those go to help sustain our newsroom as well. I'm guessing we don't make a lot of subscriptions. We do not have a paywall like the Tribune, so we rely on advertising there. It's interesting to talk about, you know, the news deserts. I'm probably the oldest one here on the panel, and I've been at the B News for 35 years, and I can just tell you what it used to be like, because I was hired here as a local news reporter. And I was assigned immediately to do a couple of suburbs, Sandy and Draper. I think Bill and Murray were in there too. And then we had other reporters assigned to the other cities. And I would spend my whole day talking to sources in those cities. I'd sit through their city council meetings till the bitter end. I would report on their budgets and everything that was happening. And I'm kind of a pack rat, so I brought an old paper from 1987. And immediately you can see just how big it is, right? And this is just the local section. So the whole thing here is just filled with local news. And it's amazing. And, you know, the truth is we didn't know who was reading these stories, how many people were reading the story, the report you have on the Draper budget. But we did know that if a city council person saw a headline there in the paper, they knew they were accountable, and they knew somebody was watching that. We're a long ways from that today. We don't have the resources to cover those cities like we used to. And I think that's a real concern going forward.
You were mentioning, I want to just go back for a moment to the financial support of church ownership. You were telling me beforehand that it's not like a regular income stream, but a fallback plan? Is that
the we used to wonder, you know, before 2010 or so, whether they were there to, where they had our backs, if they had to, because we'd made profits up until that point, and that's where when everything kind of fell off the cliff. And they did support us through that difficult time. And again, I'm not in a position of leadership where I know all the details, but from what I understood, they made it clear that they would like us to make a profit. But they also felt that we were important to the community and they wanted to keep us alive if necessary. So from what I understand, we are making a profit, very small one, or breaking even, somewhere around that position. But they are there and they do have our backs.
Josh?
Yeah, there's a really interesting kind of feature of what we know pretty well in political science that feeds into this idea that this local news coverage is actually less So there's this really broad trend that's happened over the past couple of decades, in particular on the nationalization of politics, right? This is the idea that it's not just federally elected officials, but like local and state level representatives who are focusing their issues and their campaigns on national politics. And so there's this idea then that it's not necessarily specifically like the newspaper business model or the local news business model that's leading to like lower demand for local news. It's that people just are more concerned about national politics now than they used to be. And so that's what they want to read about, right? If you're a media producing company, you want to put stuff in front of people that they want to read or watch. And that's predominantly local news. So this Sinclair business model idea, where it's both cheaper to centrally produce national news and cut journalistic resources and local outlets, that's generalizable to the news industry, especially TV, where there's both cost savings to be had by covering more local news because you don't have to spend as much money on local journalism. And it's what people, at least we think what people want to consume more of. So it's creating this sort of like vicious feedback loop where we now kind of are like stimulating more demand for national news because of these business model concerns. So I would say that we're never going to get back to a point where there's that much demand for local news. It's just, I don't think that's feasible anymore. You can get some differences in local levels where people are going to be interested in their local outlets, but kind of like broadly at a macro level, which is sort of my focus, right, is like the economics just don't make sense for there to be a really vibrant, like to have a newspaper with that large of a local news section anymore is sort of kind of hard to imagine based on what we currently know. And you know, I think that's an important consideration because it is still kind of driven by these larger political trends and what people are interested in.
Renee, do you want to jump in?
I still want to jump in.
Do it.
I disagree. I agree with your premise, but I think there is a strong appetite for local news. I think there's a strong appetite with the Draper City budget. And where we're seeing that pop up are in these news sites that are not news, the neighborhood next door, the Ask Community Facebook page. And that so concerns me because those aren't facts. Those are professional journalists who are putting that information out there. But those places are popping up because there's a vacuum of local news coverage.
But will people pay for it?
I think they will support it. So here's what we found. We went into a fall pledge drive. We wanted to raise $215,000. We had to postpone the pledge drive for a week because of that Harley's Canyon fire. Guess how much money we raised in 4 days? $350,000. $135,000 more than what we thought we would raise. And that's because people went, holy Hannah, KPCW is the only place where I can get news that directly impacts the health and safety of my family. We cover planning commissions. We cover city council meetings. We cover county council meetings. We're probably the only media outlet that recognized that Governor Cox was in New York this morning meeting with Xtel Development, which is developing MIDA. You know, that big new ski resort on the side of Wasatch County overlooking the Jordanelle. People want to know that. And we're lucky. We are so lucky in Southern Wasatch County because it is a relatively affluent community.
Yeah, that's the thing, right? I mean, so that's the real problem here. It's like we can get these like pockets.
Yeah.
But they're going to be the communities that kind of need it the least, right? Where the governance is generally going to be better because people are more paying attention. There's the money for people to be involved in politics. Mm. The representatives are coming from those areas where people are already kind of highly educated and high information voters. So these are it's good that these exist, and that's all I've lived in all my life is places like this. But that's not really representative broadly of the country. And I agree that this, I think people are trying to find information on Nextdoor for these things. It's just really unclear to me that like at a macro level, that's a business model, that there's like some latent business model that's untapped, where people are going to pay for it in a way that's actually profitable to employ journalists to go to these things, cover them. It could be the case that's wrong. My understanding, especially in local news in the past, was that was all propped up by advertising money that's completely disappeared. And then there was never a sustainable business model that was based on subscriptions. It was always propped up by advertising money. And so, like, it's just, I mean, a new nonprofit is set in the right direction, but it's still, like, outside of these kinds of communities, it's unclear to me. I mean, I could be wrong, but.
Yes, and you know, the Tribune and the D News are now both one day a week. It's expensive to do that thing down in your back there, right? And by making the transition, and at the same time, we introduced the e-edition, and now in the e-edition email is late, everybody says, where's my paper, which I think is a kick, right? Because we made the transition already, which is great, right? But we just shed a lot of cost. And I think that relying on what we know of the business model as it was is not where some organizations are today.
Actually, it's a really interesting political science paper on the effect of staff costs or staff cuts in newspapers. And what they find, as Sky Eric Peterson at Texas A&M, is that, first of all, the number of staff in newsrooms decreased between 2008 and 2015 by 40% on average, which is insane. And so for those of you who obviously know the industry well, there's no way to cover the same number of things. If you have one reporter who now had like two beats to go to like eight. So like one of my friends at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution now covers like nine different things. 5 years ago, it covered like two. So what he finds is that these staff cuts lead to 300 to 500 fewer stories on local politics in a given year. That's a lot. That's substantial. And that's breaking this like accountability mechanism where people just don't know what's going
on. So do you know how many elections there will be in Utah on November 2nd? Anyone?
A lot,
yes.
So city mayor races, yep. Couple of council races.
Your old hood, Sandy, 13 candidates for mayor. Thank you, ranked choice voting. Any guesses? How many elections? Over 230.
Yeah.
And I don't know about any of these. I'm a political scientist.
Right, precisely. and granted, it is a scotch early, not too early. But we've got a kind of set the Sully County City reporter, right? And so our plan is to go that hard with that reporter. We've added a reporter who's covering the 11 cities and towns on the west side of the valley where there is less access to local news. And we have doubled our capacity, right? Does that get us to 232 elections? No. But we have a plan for Southern Utah. We got a few interns and we're going to scrape together and we're going to do everything we can. And the ROI will not be there, right? But it is the right thing to do.
Renee, I have this fantasy of all the nonprofits teaming up, and it's like, I'll give you our Summit County, Wasatch County coverage.
I think we've been seeing a lot more of this. There's always that sense, I'm going to be first, I'm going to be exclusive, that stand out on the news. We have exclusive tonight, and we're seeing so much more cooperation between outlets. Anybody want to jump in on that?
As far as the nonprofit model goes, right, you and I have had these conversations, Elaine. We're not competitors. A rising tide lifts all boats. They want to listen to KVR in Summit Wasatch County. They're going to listen to KVR for your All Things Considered, because we don't care at that. But if they want local news, they're going to go on our website or they'll tune into our local news hour the next morning. There's a way we can complement each other, not compete. And when you take the for-profit mechanism and shareholders out of the conversation, then that conversation becomes a lot more easy.
That's a good point.
Well, and I think I'm going to stand on this side for a minute. I think it is interesting because I think there's important things that you need to be doing about the fire days later that, you know, a statewide maybe needs to move on. I've been working with KZMU and Moab because there's a lot of interest in Grant County because a lot of people may not live there, but we all go there, right? And working with KZMU, you know, there's a lot of stories that are hyper-local. But being able to partner with them and elevate their voice, their reporting, and point to their work is good for all of us. So
right. That's
pretty important. There you go. I'll just get off my hands. So we are talking about some new models, new ways of doing things, and we're looking at new ways of reaching people. We've talked about people finding their news in social media groups, etc., and I think it's becoming more important that we're meeting people where they are, through social media, through news apps, which I think everybody here has, through podcasts. And when I look at local podcasts for a minute. So the Sinclair model, right, you judging on-air time isn't going to measure the Hinckley Report, the Tribune's Utah Politics, Brian Schott. Deseret News is there for what? With Lloyd Matheson. Sinclair Station, KUTV, has Take Two. All of this is really just an excuse for me to tell you that KUPR just today relaunched a politics podcast by Sonia Benson and Emily Beans. It's called State Street. Please subscribe on your favorite app. How much does our survival depend on that idea, meeting the audience where they are, and how do we communicate even with that? This costs money. Open it up, Jake.
Oh, it's extremely valuable. It's necessary. I mean, you have to be quick to pivot and go where the audience is. And I'm sure the Tribune's the same. We hired people specifically to try to grow our audience on social media. We have people who know how to market in that way. It's kind of hard for an old dog like me, right? You know, to learn the new tricks. But I've got a Twitter handle, and I'm tweeting out. It's changed so much over the years. But the one thing you can be certain about is it's going to change again. And we have to be ready to pivot and go where the audience is, no matter what that takes.
Lauren, anyone have a favorite Instagram follow or TikTok follow they're willing to share?
Go. I like the Washington Post on TikTok.
Okay, very great. Thank you. Anyone else?
Ooh.
Non-news is okay. Yes.
I have money.
Planet Money. Okay.
Yes, so good.
Yes, it's great. Let's build on this. Okay. So Planet Money is a brand. Planet Money is not a platform, right? And I absolutely agree it is going to change. Right. And so I think the challenge for us is to build a brand that can exist across platforms. So it doesn't matter if we're talking about Instagram or TikTok or NPR.org, you know where you're going to find Planet Money, and you can find it in all these different places. Right. And so for us, we've been doing a lot of experimenting with our podcast, Mormonland. Right. How can we grow a brand that exists in real life, that exists on social, that exists in the podcast space such that people will support it via Patreon if they don't care to subscribe to the Tribune? And what is a measure of success that we're happy with such that we have built a brand versus put something on a platform and said, we're on Instagram. So I do think that we've got to think about brands or verticals versus platforms.
Renee, KTCW saw pretty big studio expansion in 2019. It was 1,400 square feet.
Double our space.
Right? Double the size, bigger master control, additional studios. How optimistic are you? How optimistic are you about the future of local news?
I am, if it hasn't come through already, I'm very optimistic about the future of local news. I think there is an appetite for it. I think that if anything, maybe the biggest challenge is finding journalists. We have an opening for two reporters. I think that's interesting. But I'm optimistic. We raised the money. We finished our fundraising shy of our goal. COVID hit. We're about to announce a nice grant from a well-known Utah family. And we think the sky's the limit. I think that our digital platform, we are, because of the international interest in the Park City community, we are seeing our streaming numbers and our web numbers have just grown 400% in the last 3 years. People are going to digital platforms, and that's how I think we can all be sharing our information as nonprofits and how we can really benefit each other. I want coverage of the Draper budget. I want coverage of the city council people. I think all politics is local, and we have a very highly political mayoral race happening right now in Park City, and people are talking about, and they want to know about it. We're holding debates. Listen like a local. That's our moment.
We might have time for one or two questions.
Maybe 5 minutes?
Yeah. Please.
So my cell phone costs about $1,000, and it's not an iPhone, it's a Samsung. Not everyone can afford a smartphone. A lot of people don't have TVs or anything like that digitally that are able to access the social media that you guys are talking about, or access local news media in that way. With the decline in physical copies of the news, are there Are those people just part of an unfortunate collateral damage of budget cuts and changing technology?
Can I just jump in real quick? I obviously don't know the news industry, but this is an interesting point, is that, that when we transition to these new platforms, is we're really kind of exacerbating the selection effect of who chooses to pursue and stay informed, which is not really anyone's fault, right? It's just a fact of the way things work now. And that's again, particularly problematic when you think about the Sinclair news, where just like literally overnight, people were just, you know, you watch the local news, especially, you know, larger kind of broader groups of society, and it just transitioned into covering less of that, and it transitioned into covering like really hyper-politicized stuff. And so there is a point here where it's like, we don't really know what happens when we push our stuff into social media and podcasts, because it's who's listening to that? We don't know.
Yeah, you know, I can remember not too long ago, people in my neighborhood would constantly talk to me about things that I'd written, right? And now they don't take the paper anymore. And some of them have said that they've apologized to me. Oh, you know, Tostin mentioned, sorry, it's only comes out once a week. But I'll read it online. But guess what? They're not reading it online. These are, you know, this is an older demographic, but these people are just, they're unaware of what's happening.
Well, that's the beauty of radio. It's free over the air. You have a radio. If you're in your car, you can listen to public radio. And what we're seeing across the country is that public radio is absorbing some of the hits that local newspapers are taking. Public radio newsrooms are expanding while local print newsrooms are shrinking. Public radio newsrooms traditionally were not very big to begin with, so comparatively, we're much smaller still. But over the air television, which makes your Sinclair case for you, and public radio. I mean, we all have our FCC licenses, the public airwaves. That's the only way I can see that audience being served.
Okay, cool. I have been involved with a lot of stuff, campaigns and stuff like that. There's an issue there, and ultimately, we're talking about, and that is the pay and the promotions are strongly influenced by how many hits their articles get. And they told me that they're disincentivized to do fair reporting and kind of reporting equally the different aspects of the story, because their experience is that if it's a little bit one-sided, a little bit edgy, maybe not quite covering all the aspects of the truth, it tends to be a headline, that the readership increases a lot. And they said that they're having trouble maintaining this journalistic standards of ethics in this environment. And I think the one thing that we haven't really mentioned here is that news outlets, the professional journalists, are competing in the playing field with people who are not compensated at all for their news gathering activities. And at some point or other, you have to ask the question, how is that really possible to have good journalists continue to ethically report?
If you heard that from anyone at the Tribune, we should have a conversation following. I would submit that, right? We have to understand user data. We have to know what people are and aren't reading. Right? We have to understand that. And at the same time, we talked about the 230 elections. Every candidate is getting the same cohort of questions. There is zero differentiation with respect to what we will ask candidates for elected office as we roll into November 2nd, right? And we will publish any response that comes in, whether 200 people read that story or two people read that story. What outlets are doing that?
Tribune, Deseret News, and Radio TV.
I mean, it does sort of make sense from like an economic perspective that people have incentives to write things that get more views. I mean, whether or not that's systematized at like an outlet level is clearly, I mean, I would never suggest that's true, but it does make sense that an individual reporter, especially in a market where there's It's tough to stick around in some ways. Again, maybe not here, but that does sort of make sense.
Well, it's interesting because there are some new outlets that I consider basically ad sheets that employ freelance people who I don't think they're among the traditional media lines, but I am aware of a couple of websites in particular, or maybe newsletters that go out where it makes sense that maybe that would be the case. But I honestly never at Fox 13 and never at KPCW and never with any journalist that I worked with did I hear I get paid for more clicks. If anything, I've heard digital revenue is pennies on the dollar compared to broadcast revenue.
Of course, I write opinion, and we never had those pressures of the opinion page. The idea is that even if you write an editorial and nobody reads, that's going to be out there on the internet, and that is a statement of our position that we may think is very important, and it keeps circulating around. And there are times when stories will suddenly start getting hits, or editorials start getting hits, and it's maybe 2 years old, and all of a sudden it's relevant again. And so we take kind of a long view when it comes, especially to opinion writing.
Well, we are out of time. I wanted to ask you each really quickly, since I talked about the State Street podcast, which you're all subscribing to. Jay, senior columnist and member of the Deseret News editorial board, what project or story are you really excited about right now? What column are you writing that you're really excited about? You should all read. Do you remember what you did yesterday? I rarely do.
Well, of course, you know, we've got a pandemic on that you may have heard about. So, you know, I'm really interested in examining what President Biden has done with his mask mandate for companies of 100 employees or more, and looking to see the legalities of that and how courts have been pretty clear that states have the rights to do that, but does the federal government? I've been fascinated by this since the beginning, because if you go back 100 years, people weren't wearing masks during the pandemic of 1918 either. And there were a lot of the similar types of things going on then that there are now. So as that continues, I'm just kind of excited about following that. I'm kind of a history nerd myself.
Watch out for Jay's column. Lauren Vestas, executive editor at Salt Lake Tribune. What are you excited about?
Last week, so the Tribune won a Pulitzer well before my time for its coverage of BYU's honor code and honor code communications. And we reported on that story in 2017. Last week, we just received word that we would receive documents that we asked for initially in that story. 5 years later, countless lawsuits, too much money in a courtroom. So stay tuned. We'll have that soon.
Renee Bodley Miller, president and general manager of public radio station KPCW. What should we check out from your team?
The buzzword in Summit and Wasatch Counties is growth. How do we preserve these beautiful open rural spaces that we've loved to recreate and manage growth while also providing affordable housing to our communities? It's an ongoing battle and we'll always be covering it.
Joshua McCrane is assistant professor of political science at the University of Utah, working on a paper on the effects bonus for state legislative elections. When do we get to talk about that?
Yeah, so Greg Martin, my co-author at Stanford, we're almost out with a paper that really does a lot to bolster the idea that we should have lots of local public news, which is that conglomeration of media ownership. So not just Sinclair, but any major media group, when they buy up stations, That market where they bought the station up, the local political races become less competitive because people know less about what's going on in politics. So you should support local news because of that.
That's our show. This program is made possible by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Anthony Scoma, your producer and host of this program. As always, thanks for listening.